The project was initially understood as yet another doomed attempt to construct a digital currency by the disillusioned cypherpunk community. And without anyone's permission, Bitcoin slowly emerged and diligently grew to become adopted by a small group of computer researchers, cryptographers, and engineers curious to decipher the technology. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What's up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I just love the topic of the history of the internet, the inner workings and level of complexity that goes on in the protocols that make up the internet. It's one of still to this day, one of my favorite Guy's Take episodes is the one where I talk about how the internet is too complex to work, because it's so fascinating digging into the level of like the routing protocols that happen in your modem and router, the layers of things that are always talking and are always operational in a computer, and that we could actually just have all of this working in the background and operating at all times on just a device that we carry around in our pocket, and that it could constantly switch back and forth between one communication protocol and another, between cell phone and Wi-Fi, and that we basically don't even see it happening. It's just so crazy, the level of things that are going on. And it's, like I said, it's just a fascinating topic of mine. We've got an article from Bitcoin Magazine today talking all about this, hitting the history of the internet and how we're finally bringing money, an actual monetary layer to the internet. It is by Tubal Marichal. And you can find some really great, he's been on a couple of great podcasts. He's been on John Vallis's podcast. He's been on Kayvon Devani's podcast. So I'll link to those if you want to listen to some conversations with Tubal. And we're going to jump right into his article about finally bringing money to the internet protocol. And it is titled, A Monetary Layer for the Internet. ARPANET's first mark into networked computing. Created in February 1958, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA, was a response to the Soviet launch of Sputnik 1, the first artificial Earth satellite, to research and develop projects in technology and science beyond direct U.S. military applications. Bob Taylor, an ARPA computer scientist, convinced a colleague to support a research project using funding from a ballistic missile defense program. Following 3 years of research, the ARPANET project was launched as the first network to connect two geographically distinct computers. On October 29th, 1969, at 10:30 p.m. Pacific Time, the first successful message, LO, was sent from UCLA in Los Angeles to Stanford University in Silicon Valley. The message was supposed to say log in, but the system crashed. Over 7 years later, Queen Elizabeth II was sending her first email from a computer installed in the UK. Unbeknownst to most, ARPANET was morphing into a small but fast-growing global communication network. Rising computer network protocols. The ARPANET was the first public implementation of TCP/IP, two major protocols that now form an integral part of the Internet Protocol Suite. Taken together, this suite constitutes what we know as the Internet, the global interconnected network that hundreds of millions of humans use daily without ever being aware of it. As additional computer nodes joined the ARPANET in different countries, novel technologies were developed to make the growing network more usable, most notably through standard network protocols. Public computer protocols were created to govern how data is created, exchanged, and interpreted between clients and servers on the same interconnected network, including Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, or SMTP, to send and receive emails, file transfer protocol, or FTP, to exchange and read files, or hypertext transfer protocol, HTTP, to structure and display web pages that we browse today. HTTP is one of the most well-known public protocols. It turned ARPANET into the World Wide Web that is now commonly called the Internet or the Web, and established a standard for computers to communicate on the open application layer of the Internet, having built on other layers of public protocols and open source technologies. The Internet's onion shape. The Internet is built in layers, first abstracted in a framework called the Open Interconnection System, or OSI model, which was later reinterpreted by a simpler version based on the TCP/IP architecture. The OSI model is a logical construction that defines network communication used by various computer systems that interact with each other. As the Internet morphed into a more sophisticated global network of computers, the OSI model was published to help decouple seven distinct layers of public protocols useful in the creation, exchange, and interpretation of data flows. As a hierarchical system, public computer network protocols coordinate how data moves across the Internet's seven layers. Each layer is solely responsible for performing assigned tasks and transferring completed tasks to the next layer for further processing. This clear specialization ensures performance, reliability, and scalability of the Internet. The seven protocol layers of the Internet. We start at layer one, the physical layer, where the function is simply to send the data across the physical wires. This includes the hubs, NICs, the very cables that connect computers across the Internet. Then layer two, we have the data link layer. This is where devices communicate with the MAC address. Examples include switches, Ethernet, and Wi-Fi. Then we have the network layer, layer three. This is where the IP address is read from the incoming data packets. This includes our routers and our other layer 3 switches. Then the transport layer, layer 4. This is responsible for the transport protocols and error handling. This includes TCP and UDP protocols. Then the session layer, layer 5. This is where we establish and end connections between two hosts who are exchanging data. This includes protocols like NetBIOS and PPTP. Then layer 6, the presentation layer. This is the layer where data is formatted so it can be viewed by the user. This is also where encryption and decryption takes place. Examples being JPEG images, GIFs, SSL, and TLS. And finally, the application layer, layer 7. This is where services that are used for end-user applications. Examples being HTTP for the web, FTP for transferring files, DNS for our domain names, and SMTP for email. The Internet is a multi-layered global distributed network of computers that we use every day for many things without ever questioning its existence. Though only 30 years old, the Internet powers an immense amount of trade between an ever-growing number of consumers, companies, and nations, accounting for roughly $28 trillion in 2016. Long before Amazon was a thing, in 1972, students from Stanford and MIT conducted the first ever online transaction using ARPANET. The first good ever sold on the Internet was marijuana. Many projects followed as commercial and academic attempts to create electronic cash, making commerce native on the Internet. All incommensurably failed from the late 1980s to the early 2000s, including B-Money, DigiCash, HashCash, and BitGold. Technology capacity limits, regulatory hurdles, and centralization particularly prevented mainstream digital currencies from ever taking off. The missing monetary layer of the web. Regardless, for users to directly trade with geographically distinct neighbors on the Internet, one essential component has been absent until now: a monetary layer to store, exchange, and measure value natively on the web without being required to use legacy financial institutions. Over two decades, failed attempts at creating digital money paved the way to a reckoning and the silent launch of an open-source software project on a cypherpunk mailing list back in 2008. Satoshi Nakamoto was the pseudonym of an unknown individual or group who posted about the Bitcoin project with a link to the white paper explaining how it works. The project was initially understood as yet another doomed attempt to construct a digital currency by the disillusioned cypherpunk community. And without anyone's permission, Bitcoin slowly emerged and diligently grew to become adopted by a small group of computer researchers, cryptographers, and engineers curious to decipher the technology. Fast forward 11 years. Bitcoin proved to be resilient to attacks, bugs, and serious technical and political crises. There are hundreds of developers actively working on this project with more than $200 billion in monetary base. Bitcoin's latest running software, 0.20.0, released in June 2020, has created and maintained the world's first form of absolute digital scarcity. Without ever breaking the integrity of its underlying ledger, it does not rely on trusted third parties to verify that everything is running well. Everyone and anyone can take the role of verification on the Bitcoin network. This had never been achieved in the past. Bitcoin solved a multi-decades-long problem in computer science called the Byzantine Generals problem, which highlights the complexity of coordinating untrusted nodes in a distributed network. LNP-BP as public network protocols. Bitcoin is growing into the internet's native monetary layer, functioning as a suite of public network protocols referred to as LNP-BP. Bitcoin has undeniably scarce units of value. It is a network of storable, movable, and quantifiable value. What does LNP-BP stand for? As a self-contained economic system on the internet, Bitcoin is powered by energy and protected by a global network of computing power that voluntarily regulates the integrity of Bitcoin's ledger and its digitally scarce monetary units. The self-organized configuration is unbreakable and decentralized like the internet itself. Together, the Bitcoin protocol, BP, and its Lightning Network protocol, LNP, are joining the ranks of other open network protocols akin to TCP/IP. The Bitcoin protocol has movable units of scarce value that can flow within its network, similar to the Internet Protocol, IP. The Lightning Network protocol, or LNP, acts as a second layer built on top of BP, which permits nearly instant, cheap, and anonymous exchanges of data packets on BP, similarly to how the Transfer Communication Protocol, TCP, does it with the Internet Protocol. LNP-BP is the Bitcoin suite of protocols, responsible for the rise of a native monetary layer of the Internet, adding a division to the TCP/IP model's current stack. Bitcoin represents the world's first bytes of data with an intrinsic financial value, priced by the physical world in the form of energy, protected by the first law of thermodynamics. Software now has a built-in price tag. Code is valuable without any specific application because of its remarkable scarcity. Scarcity isn't a concept that is limited by physical boundaries anymore. Scarcity can provably be digital, and is actually the first and only form of absolute scarcity discovered by mankind, which questions its provable existence in the analog world. Absolute scarcity now exists in its most intangible form, bits, the portmanteau for digital binary digits. A silent monetary evolution. Bitcoin is agnostic about any human inventions, such as legacy institutions, governments, central banks, or corporations. Internet users can simply acquire, trade, hold, and use Bitcoin as they see fit. no single entity controls the protocol. It is governed by open source software, which is voluntarily run by tens of thousands of independent node operators. Computer nodes in the network play two roles around Bitcoin's ledger, called the time chain, by either writing or reading transactions. Bitcoin's time chain is a chain of blocks, which transcribes a suite of bundled transactions that are recorded sequentially by one set of computers called miners. Often referred to as the blockchain, which is more appropriate for other cryptocurrencies desperately trying to mimic Bitcoin, the term time chain is more accurate to describe Bitcoin's ledger as it ties to the original semantic used by Bitcoin's pseudonymous creator, Satoshi Nakamoto. A free market of rational volunteers. Miners are powerful computers with specialized hardware dedicated toward writing transactions to Bitcoin's ledger. In a public computational contest, vast amounts of energy are expended by miners to brute force random alphanumeric strings in an effort to guess a random code, akin to a digital lottery. Bitcoin miners' contributions to the network are measured as hash rate, which is a function of the total computational power allocated to the network, which is currently hitting new all-time highs at approximately 125.2 exahashes per second. Once that random code, called a nonce, is found by a computer in the network, it proves that the miner has completed enough work in the form of energy and time expenditure. This is commonly referred to as proof of work, which allows all computers in the Bitcoin network to verify that the system stays fair and honest. The lucky computer, or mining pool as they often combine computing power for efficiency, can then gather a batch of unconfirmed transactions from a queue called the mempool and bundle them into a block to permanently write that block of transactions into Bitcoin's ledger. To be granted permission to write on Bitcoin's ledger, there is no shortcut, such as political influence, hierarchy, or seniority. Each participant adding information to Bitcoin's ledger needs to earn it through proven work that they must demonstrate to the network using the random nonce. In return for their service to the network, miners receive a block reward, including a subsidy with new Bitcoin, currently 6.25 Bitcoin per block, as well as transaction fees paid for by users seeking Bitcoin transaction settlement. This is the only way for new Bitcoin to be issued. It must be earned via provable energy expenditure. Since 2018, Bitcoin has shifted the world into an era of exahash computing. If one were to gather the 500 top supercomputers all together, they would represent only 1.6% of Bitcoin's hash rate. It is dwarfing the world's computing horsepower by multiple orders of magnitude, creating a robust computational defense mechanism, preventing malicious actors from controlling the network and double spending Bitcoin using the majority of the hash rate, which is an attack often referred to as a 51% attack. A self-managed computing organism. Bitcoin's ledger is secured and managed by cryptography. On average, a new block of transactions is added every 10 minutes, no matter what happens in the world. Each time, this creates new Bitcoin on the network in the form of the block subsidy for the lucky miners. The block subsidy used to be 50 Bitcoin, which was halved according to the protocol specifications in 2012. In 2016, and in May 2020, bringing the current block subsidy to 6.25 Bitcoin per block today. This process is called the halving. Halving events happen every 210,000 blocks that are added to the Bitcoin's ledger. It is the only rule that controls the issuance of new Bitcoin. It will continue roughly every 4 years until all 21 million Bitcoin are mined, which should happen approximately in the year 2140. The discovery rate of Bitcoin slows down over time until it ultimately turns to zero. No new Bitcoin will be found after that moment in time. As new adoption increases demand, the number of Bitcoin goes up, which incentivizes participants to join. Opportunistically, new miners are attracted to the Bitcoin network to mine blocks of transactions and receive the valuable block reward. As more computers join the network and produce a larger collective hash rate, Bitcoin is automatically adjusting the difficulty of the mining lottery. Roughly every 2 weeks, or 2016 blocks, mining either becomes harder or easier based on how much hash rate there is at this given time. It is the most reliable way to have Bitcoin blocks mined roughly every 10 minutes, keeping the issuance schedule highly stable and predictable, regardless of the network's aggregate hash rate. Toward universal financial integrity. Since its first block, mined on January 3, 2009 by Satoshi Nakamoto, Bitcoin has been up 99.98% of the time and has never validated a malicious or wrong transaction, which is unprecedented for legacy financial institutions. This is only possible because verifying Bitcoin transactions is very accessible. While writing new transactions on the ledger is extremely costly, reading them to verify the integrity of the ledger is easy and accessible to all. Full validating nodes can be operated on computers less powerful than what many people have at home or at work, making it trivial and affordable to verify the history of the Bitcoin transactions. Anybody can run them. This makes Bitcoin an impenetrable fortress of security, as everyone can check every single transaction that ever happened in Bitcoin. It's an openly auditable ledger. Miners and full node operators voluntarily run a version of the Bitcoin software that is compatible with the majority of the network. This maintains a general consensus on the shared rules of the network, such as the block size, which dictates how many transactions can be included in a block by miners. Large miners are incentivized to grow the size of blocks to include more transactions, gaining additional fees and making it more costly for newcomers and small participants. Full node operators choose voluntarily to run a version of the software to keep block size small, to make verification accessible to everyone. Miners have to be compatible with full nodes to have the mined blocks be verified and approved. If Bitcoin's block size grows, more powerful computers are required to run full nodes with extra memory and bandwidth, which will centralize verification, adding a level of trust in the system, especially around miners. Bitcoin's current block size is approximately 2 megabytes, with a theoretical block size of 4 megabytes with the SegWit upgrade, and has been challenged many times in the past. The most serious attack was in 2017 under the form of a hard fork called Bitcoin Cash, or Bcash, which copied Bitcoin's software and transaction history and adjusted the code to raise the block size up to 8 megabytes. Deviations such as Bcash are the unavoidable byproduct of the open source nature of Bitcoin, which lets anyone create forks of Bitcoin's time chain, though the market continues to value these forks at a substantially discounted value. Liberating modern capital markets. As the internet liberated free information between global peers, Bitcoin is liberating capital exchange, creating open, fair, and social markets in which anyone can participate. New companies exclusively built on Bitcoin's base layer and/or Lightning are making it safer and easier for sovereign people to opt out of the legacy banking system. As trust-minimized agents, companies building on Bitcoin and Lightning are pushing for reasonable adoption with ethical principles and a core focus on security, usability, and sovereignty. Whether working on non-custodial private key management, Lightning channel capacity distribution, protocol implementations, or peer-to-peer Bitcoin exchanges, Bitcoin-native companies make the capital flow from the legacy banking system into Bitcoin possible. Bitcoin-native companies are creating massive economic upside potential for this new internet monetary layer, and will be building a Bitcoin-based economic system in the next 20 to 30 years, with almost no doubt. This is a guest post by Thibaut Marichal of Knox. Opinions expressed are entirely his own and do not necessarily reflect those of Bitcoin Incorporated or Bitcoin Magazine. This article was originally published on Medium. All right, so This was this is going to spark, like, I want to talk about a lot of the things that he brought up in this article, because this is just kind of like that general step back. What does it look like to literally have a monetary layer for the internet? Now, we don't actually have a sponsor for today's episode, so I will just say, don't forget to subscribe and share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin space. And of course, if you want to sponsor the show, if you want to support the podcast, you can become a patron at patreon.com or hit me up at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com or just DM me on Twitter too. If you've got like a project or a wallet or something that you are building or want to get the word out for the Bitcoin space, I would love to talk to you about it and dig into what you got. I'd be very interested to hear, and it might be something that would be great for the audience. So again, hit me up on Twitter at The Crypto Economy or email at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com. One of the things I love about digging into the history of the internet, though, is that the MIT students in Massachusetts, like when they were basically exchanging information with the Stanford University, that literally the first thing ever sold that the students sold to each other was a dime bag of marijuana. That was the first thing ever transacted on the internet, which I think is too perfect a parallel with Bitcoin's early history and the first initial market that spurred in the Bitcoin space, which was the Silk Road, which, you know, sold massive amounts of marijuana. There's a book called The Dark Net by Jamie Bartlett that actually kind of digs into the very early it details out that transaction actually between MIT and Stanford really gets into how the counterculture of the 60s and 70s and really the hackers were so pivotal in shaping the computer industry, like the idea of the internet and how it was used and its fundamental protocols at times. And you actually see this too in my Bitcoin Survivors reading list on thecryptoeconomy.com. Another great piece or another great book to dive into that is Exploding the Phone. How Hacking My Bell is the subtitle of the book, but it's about the AT&T phone network and essentially the first hackers on AT&T's permission network, how they figured out how there was a great story about a blind guy who could hear, could really pick out the tones in the AT&T phone network. And the mechanical system, when they actually created an automated analog system, it actually operated and routed calls based on these tones. I mean, that's why you press the buttons and each one gives a unique tone. But the subtleties in these things and how the analog system would act, how the switching system on the AT&T network would actually operate, there would be exclusive tones for like maintenance lines and stuff so that they could connect. And there was actually a guy who happened to be blind who could whistle his way through the network. He could literally create these tones so perfectly with whistling that he could establish connections by whistling into his receiver. And they literally tried to prosecute the guy for whistling into his phone because he could make long distance phone calls halfway around the world for free, which, you know, at the time it was an exorbitant amount of money to do this. And this was kind of the foundation of the phone freaks. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were actually like a big part of it. They made those black boxes that they actually sold to other students or whatever that would automate these things and utilize the maintenance lines and make long distance phone calls for free. There was a story of like, I mean, they would just do stuff to have fun with it. There was one guy, there's one little story in the book about a guy who was calling his friend who was just down the street, and he purposefully routed the call to like New York, to Japan, back to Oregon. Like he routed it to like 18 different places so that he was literally having to go around, the signal was having to travel the distance of like, you know, around the globe, like multiple times just to call his friend who was down the street. And then when they connected, like the delay was really bad and it was just like, like it was just nothing but hiss or whatever, and you could hear this distance like, hey, can you hear me? I mean, this was the culture that birthed the internet, right? And and the counterculture had a lot to do with it. It really did. And there's numerous early books about the birth of the internet and the birth of the computer industry. I mean, this was Steve Jobs. It created the personal computer, essentially. And that dream of a decentralized, permissionless network was extremely appealing to that philosophy, to the cypherpunk idea, and the idea of that open toy, you know, like that network where you could just do whatever you wanted, and there were no masters, there was nobody to tell you what to do. It existed per its own rules. And Bitcoin is changing that. Bitcoin is doing that for money, and it's attracting exactly the same people in an even deeper, diehard manner, because it's specifically the rebels, it's the libertarians, it's those who understand how corrupt the old system is and the power of a system that could potentially replace it. And I think that's making a huge move to shape what Bitcoin is. It shapes the culture around it, the idea of sovereignty, the rules of Bitcoin, the not your keys, not your coins. Like, don't trust anyone. Like, don't trust Verify. Like, these things are deeply philosophical ideas made in this seemingly like kind of shallow, frivolous idea of just like this fun cultural thing. But they aren't. They go a lot deeper. HODL even is a meme that has great depth to it. It's a declaration. It's a stance of that low time preference idea of just a recognition of the potential of this in the long term, and the realization of the volatility and the amount of the scope of the battle that is happening. You know, like, there's going to be volatility. There are going to be great shifts and stressors in this ecosystem. And, you know, if you can't hold it, if you can't hold through that and have strong hands and understand the true potential of this thing and the true amount of change that it's going to bring to the world, well, then you need to get out. You know, like, you need to be washed out. You're not ready for it. Come back when you are. Another really interesting thing that he points out in this piece is the power of verification, that one of the most important elements of the Bitcoin system is not that it's just open and anyone can write to the ledger. In fact, that has one of the biggest barriers in the Bitcoin system, but that verification and auditability of the system is what makes it distributed and what eliminates any power hierarchy in the system. And that's such a critical and nuanced thing that so many people miss. I mean, the whole block size debate was about exactly that, is what was it that truly protected the Bitcoin system from corruption and from cheating, essentially? And that absolutely is the low cost to verify all of the data in the system. You know, like, there are a couple of different ways that you can prevent someone from being able to check your work, right? Like, to be able to prevent the ability to verify that no one has corrupted the rules or the system itself. And, you know, one of those, which is very common, is to keep it secret, is to not allow access, to not let people see it, and to not let anybody participate. But another one is just to overwhelm them with the amount of data. You know, if nobody can afford to check all the information, if you just spam it with a whole bunch of nonsense, you get the same level of obscurity. Like, imagine if, you know, I wanted to verify that YouTube hadn't violated its rule sets, its set of rules with all the data that's uploaded to YouTube servers, and I had to check all of it. Well, there's something like 100 hours or something stupid like that uploaded to YouTube every second. And we're talking about like thousands of petabytes of information that, like, I could never, like you might as well just ask me to audit the Federal Reserve. There's functionally no difference. It's not possible for me to do that And because they allow me to log into the servers and look at it, it makes no difference. I don't have the resources to ever audit every bit of information. But the verification process of Bitcoin is such that the only way that you can actually verify that the rules have been followed is to verify every transaction in a sequential order, all of the blocks from Genesis to the current block height. And, you know, we hoped, like, even Satoshi himself, like, tried to argue that maybe there would be a shortcut, there would be a way to create some set of proofs that allowed you to know that the data inside the block was honest and followed the rules based on just a filter, just kind of like the neutrino idea. But it never panned out. It turned out to be a problem almost as difficult as the Byzantine generals problem. And there's none yet that doesn't have some sort of trade-off in, oh, well, you can verify signatures, but you can't verify the inflation rate. Like only with a full audit of the entire system can you verify without any assumptions, and therefore without any trust, that the entire system has not been corrupted. That is what makes Bitcoin powerful. That is what makes it independent. That is what makes it a trust-minimized system, an independent asset in the digital space with provable security. You prove it, period. And so many people took so long to grasp that. I mean, myself, I had a really hard time wrapping my head around that important aspect of Bitcoin and what those trade-offs were. It was, you know, years of arguments and debates and going back and forth and reading this person and that person and all of these implementations. I mean, it was crazy during the 2015 to 17 period, and nobody was really nice about it, so it was pretty hard to navigate. But when we dig into the history of the internet, when we, like, talk about the protocol stack of the internet, it's amazing how many things. I truly think this is going to be built in a very similar way. First, it just shows us how scalability actually works. And this is actually common in nature. This is something that is present across the board. This is kind of a basic understanding. This is the fundamental nature of evolution, that it operates in layers, that it will maintain one fundamental element of the system and essentially create one function. And then after that function is hardened, after that is securely maintained among the disorder of the universe, well, then the next layer is able to utilize that and provide some other function. We actually see this in our own evolution. We see this in DNA that builds, that is able to secure and create individual cells and then communities of cells. DNA is kind of that recipe that allows the instructions to be copied and secured, and also allows those instructions in the recipe to adapt to changing environments by allowing certain cells to die, by allowing variation between, genetic communication that, you know, creates mutation to evolve to a new environment. And then that establishes cells, and then the cells have a set of communication protocols, essentially, that allow the distinction of certain organs that create unique and individual functions that together as a system can then create an organism. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's layers upon layers upon layers upon layers within just natural biological evolution. But then we see the exact same thing in communication technologies. We see it on all of our technologies, actually. And the internet is no different. In fact, the internet is such a hodgepodge of just protocols on top of protocols on top of protocols. Like I mentioned earlier, is that Guy's Take episode about how the internet is too complex to work. I actually think that Bitcoin and the Lightning Network are profoundly simple in comparison to the mess that is the rest of the internet. I mean, there are so many different protocols and routing mechanisms, and even at the physical layer, we have so many different mechanisms of exchanging the information between, like, there's analog cable, then we have broadband with digital over the analog spectrum, then we have Like just looking at a cable line, the analog signal is actually modulated. I think it's four different ways to actually pack the information, and we keep finding new bands and new ways to make that information denser, because the cleaner the actual connection is, and the less outside influence, like, you know, just radio waves and stuff that are actually getting into the network, the finer you can make the distinctions between a wave and frequency and amplitude and all of these things just in an analog signal. And if you'll notice, if you look at your modem, like modems over time, they start adding new bands and they add increasing depth to the bands that are already being used, because, you know, it used to be you have to have this like great amplitude shift to measure a zero and a one. And now you can actually do blocks where there's, you can have amplitude over this whole range of stuff, and each variation, each difference in the variation of the amplitude actually measures 4 bits as opposed to a single bit. So there's like these quadrants. I mean, the level of complexity in just sending an analog signal, then you've got fiber, you've got hubs, you've got modifications between all of these things. This is just at the physical layer. Then you start moving up this thing. You've got switches, you've got the Ethernet system, you've got MAC addresses, you've got Wi-Fi. The level of complexity at just in specialized Wi-Fi, like, it's actually got it. So the reason your Wi-Fi router has multiple antennas now is because they triangulate your position, and the way you can actually get a better signal by having the signals overlap. So like where you have like a normal signal where it dissipates and gets quote unquote thinner, like as it extends out, as you're further away from the router, well, it can actually shift the pulses, and it does this. This is something that's active all the time, and it can adjust in about, you know, in basically fractions of a second. But that it will actually locate where you are based on the difference in response time for each antenna, and then it will either delay or speed up the pulsing of the frequency of a different antenna, so that you actually get hit with the waves where you are standing specifically, gets hit with both the waves at the exact same time, so that you actually get a spike. Because if you ever see two waves like running into each other, you'll notice the wave, like one's coming from the left, one's coming from the right. When they hit each other, the amplitude doubles right when they cross. Well, the same thing happens in a Wi-Fi signal. So as soon as, if you're standing right where those things happen to run into each other, well, then you actually have a much stronger signal, even though you're 50 feet away from the Wi-Fi router. Again, this is just one of so many different layers of changing and specializing just in wireless communication, just in a Wi-Fi signal. And there's multiple protocols at work trying to make these things happen. And just like he said in this piece, is that level of specialization allows these things to evolve so much faster than anything else. This is one of the fundamental reasons why doing everything at the base layer is so stupid, because, you know, pardon me for anybody who thinks that's the way this should work, but it's dumb. It's dumb from an evolutionary perspective of how technology actually moves. If you specialize the ownership and the security at the base layer, and then put payments at a higher layer and liquidity, like create a market for actually establishing liquidity networks like Lightning does, you separate those jobs and you can just get so much additional complexity and the speed of the evolution of these protocols by separating them out, by making them specialized layers and specialized protocols. And we see this already. Lightning is moving 1,000 times faster than the Bitcoin base layer can. And by having the payments and privacy networks built on top of Bitcoin as a second layer, it doesn't have any of those massive, slow, ridiculous hurdles that the base layer does with making even minor changes. Imagine if every single time you wanted to make a website, you had to actually get consensus for everyone in the world to update their routers, their modems, their computers, so that you can install your website. That's the equivalent of trying to make a new feature at the Bitcoin base layer. And that's why centralization is the only thing that makes that move faster. And centralization is the exact opposite of an independent, sound monetary layer on the internet. It's just a horrible, horrible idea. But the beauty of it is that minor changes to the Bitcoin base layer, minor changes like Taproot that just institute one new signature type within, you know, a small subset, like a really small footprint of code that's basically operating inside a bucket of something else that we already know the security assumptions of, and that the risk of actually implementing is incredibly small compared to some sort of fundamental change in consensus. The benefits of that is that you can do so much more with it when you have a layer two, when you have a layer three, and these other things built on top of it. But I was actually talking with one of the most bullish conversations that I've had recently was with a Paul from Sphinx. Sphinx is that chat app that runs over Lightning Network. It basically just allows you to have your public key on the Lightning Network, and you use it both as your identity, your way to send and receive payments on this chat app. And I'm part of a group like the Sphinxtagram group, and I try to keep up with it, but it's hard just because I've got so many freaking chat situations and Telegram and all this stuff going on. But it's fascinating to see this thing starting to move and like really come into its own. I think it's going to be a huge thing. I really hope it comes out sooner rather than later for the full public, because I think it's just an awesome tool and I want more people on it. I want to have that larger network. But one of the things he said, Paul has been working with internet protocols and stuff way back in the early 90s and late 80s, like ages ago. He was working on all of these things when they were still in their theoretical stage, when people were dreaming up what the web might look like. I think he was actually working on one of the first browsers, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember exactly his some of his major like points of history, but we were just really digging into it, and I love this topic, you know, just the fascination of how the internet came about. And what's so funny is that the way he said it is he said that, you know, when he was working on that stuff back then, it all seemed so iffy. Like everything was such a kind of a mess of like, is this even going to work? Is it secure? Like, how do we even know? Like, is there any way this is going to be able to be installed on somebody's system? Is this just going to crash constantly? What are the, you know, huge complications and working out the communication and all this stuff? And he was just like all of it was completely up in the air. It almost seemed like a joke that one thing worked or one thing ended up becoming the standard and the other thing different. Like, it was just like nobody had a clue. But like, and then I asked him to compare that. It's like, so what's that like working on Lightning? Like, does Lightning feel like that too? Is it like we don't really know what the standards are going to be? And he basically said, no, I've never worked on anything that was so obviously going to be a powerhouse, that was going to be the standard later on. And he basically dreamed, like basically said, you know, I think we'll get to a point very, very quickly that we'll have transactions that don't need channels, where you'll be able to send money to somebody just at, like on a whim, where they boot up a wallet and then you send them money by their public key over Lightning. And essentially there's an ethereal Lightning channel, one that just kind of exists and could be published if you wanted it to, but it's not even necessary. But it does obviously mean that you're trusting the friend or whoever it is that you got the transaction from. But, you know, in the nature of a social network, that's what you do. You trust your friends. So that's a trust trade-off that's really easy to perform in certain contexts. Like, I could obviously trust my brother if he sent me a transaction over a Lightning channel that didn't actually exist yet. And we see this actually being done in some contexts already, like, what is it? The Phoenix app. Which I think is still available only for Android now. But that's actually what they do. They create, there's just something referred to as a turbo channel. And what it does is it actually, they'll push the initial payment to you in a channel that's set up and broadcast the channel. But it basically recognizes that, okay, well, you know, we could take this to chain if we wanted to, and you have the keys, like I've signed it over to a public key for you. It's not set in the Bitcoin time chain yet, but it's good enough. It's good enough for a trust minimized relationship to basically get going. And what's funny is that since you're already trusting them, if you make a payment forward on that app, you're actually trusting them less if they route a payment for you. So like if I've got $10 on it and I want to spend $5 forward, well, then now my channel, I'm only trusting them $5 worth. So I can go ahead and just start spending. And there's no reason, like all I'm doing is lowering my trust problem if I go ahead and start spending. So there's no reason for me to not go ahead and just use the app. And there's a lot of things exactly like that. There's another opcode that's been, you know, working on the Bitcoin base layer called Check Template Verify, which will basically make this much, much easier and will enable a handful of really clever things on the Lightning Network. One of those being push payments, where essentially you can watch the network, but your Lightning Network node can be offline, but someone can push a payment to your public key, and without you even signing, they can sign their half of the transaction of the update of the channel, and you'll actually still be able to identify it when you come online. If somebody ever broadcasts that channel to the Bitcoin time chain, that you'll be able to recognize it and still enforce the latest version of the contract, even though you may not have gotten it. And that's a really, really powerful tool. That's the kind of situation where you have a future where Lightning payments, there is no waiting for channels. There's no waiting to connect like that bridge in, you know, early internet days where you had to wait for all the crap to go and the like all the, you know, noises to connect your 56K modem, and getting online was like a real headache. And then suddenly there was just kind of this transition and we were always online. Like we're just always online. There's no connecting to the internet. You're just on the internet. Like my phone is connected to the internet multiple different ways, and it just trades between which one is the best at any given time. And I think Lightning is going to start working exactly the same way. And the increased functionality and the scope of what you can do with Lightning is just going to be incredible. And then to be able to enable micropayments and all of this stuff. And like I've said multiple times on Twitter, it's already been like a 50x improvement in scaling for me. I've done hundreds of transactions over Lightning, and I do it all the time, every day. Crap, I haven't done my fold. I've got to do my fold wheel. I'm spinning it right now. I think this is actually the last of my 7 days. I'm getting those free sats, man. Oh no, I got 36 minutes until it's free. Okay, good. I'm leaving this open. I'm not gonna miss that. But I use Lightning constantly. Like I've explained hundreds of times, I use the fold and strike combination. Every time Bitcoin's been dipping, I've been like offloading like into my Lightning wallets and filling that stuff up. I use some of the custodial wallets. I use plenty of the non-custodial ones too. I still screw around with Sphinx, even though like I'm just kind of in a random group of people. But it's such a fun tool. And actually, the Lightning Network, while we can still see it, which I think is a limited scope, I think there will be a point in time where we won't be able to see what's happening on the Lightning Network, which is going to be both sad that we can't like look at Lightning Network statistics, but it's going to be awesome from a context of privacy. But Lightning Network is reaching an all-time high in liquidity and channels. And I don't mean that because, you know, the price went up. I mean it in the context of, no, we've got more Bitcoin locked up in channels. And operational, and it's getting used like crazy. Like my node has been routing transactions for the last couple of months, and for a long time it didn't. Use has gone up for me in every possible context, and it's so much easier now. I truly think this is going to be the birth of the monetary web. I think just incremental improvements to Lightning are going to have drastic effects on how easy and broad the scope of use that this technology has. And another important thing to point out is that we haven't had a bull cycle with Lightning yet. Like, we have not had a hype cycle. We have not had another bull run in Bitcoin since Lightning was on the table. The amount of scaling and the number of people and services and companies that we can onboard this time are orders of magnitude greater than they were in the last hype cycle. So I'm extremely, extremely curious to see how this rolls when we have Strike, when we have all of these Lightning all these Lightning wallets to onboard people, both custodial and non-custodial. We've got Breeze, we've got Phoenix, we've got Wallet of Satoshi, we've got Blue Wallet. And we're going to learn so much more about Lightning liquidity and channel management during this phase as well, because just Strike alone, Jack Mallers talks about like some of the modifications they've done and how much better reliability on payments has been just with some minor updates. Granted, I don't think I've had a Strike payment fail, if I'm not mistaken. No, that's not true. That's not true. I've definitely had one payment fail. Because that was actually because one of my channels on the BTC Pay server was not responding for like 2 days. So I don't know who you blame that on exactly. But I've already been ranting for quite some time here. I will say one thing that I mentioned this on the show before, but I love that he calls it the time chain and refers to it as the time chain. And you know what's funny? There was actually a thread by Peter Todd. He actually didn't like the time chain term. He said it focuses on the wrong thing because it's not what's not important, or the timing of the transactions is not important, like specifically when the transaction happened, but that there is the absence of double spins, and that you need a volume for those spins to be defined in. And that blockchain suggests this better. I completely disagree. I love the term time chain because, particularly from the context of somebody who's looking at the system, because it's not about the timing. I don't think time chain has anything to do about the timing of transactions, but the order of transactions. And that's actually how you ensure that there are no double spins. But again, I think from the context of the user, it actually makes more sense because blockchain is so freaking generic. What the hell is a block? Like, what is that? Like from trying to explain this to a noob, they don't understand what the hell. Like, blockchain isn't going to give any better information than time chain. In fact, just the opposite. Time chain, I think, is far more intuitive for what the blockchain does. The role of the blockchain, yes, is to prevent double spins by proving a chronology of the events. And in doing so, it's telling the history of Bitcoin, the indisputable, concrete history of Bitcoin, the time that has occurred in the past. So it's not explicit time, it's relative time. That the time chain tells, that it informs. And that's our metric of it. It's Bitcoin history. So I personally think time chain is a perfect, that's a stretch. It is not a perfect term, but it is a much better term than blockchain. Not to mention blockchain has just been completely bastardized and is now just associated with a whole bunch of scams and nonsense, and alone is just like, oh, I am blockchain, and like, you know, like they ruined crypto, and I hate that because I loved the crypto economy term, but you know, now it kind of puts a bad taste in my mouth. Same thing kind of happened with blockchain. So let's go back. Let's do time chain. That's what Satoshi said, and that's the role of the time chain anyway. That's the role of the Bitcoin chain. It tells and secures the history of Bitcoin. Okay, we will close that out here. I have gone on long enough for Guy's take in this episode. Just really love this article, and I love getting running on this sort of thought process and the history of the internet and how the internet is built and runs, because I think I think not only does it present such a good analogy as to how Bitcoin will evolve, and as to why the layered approach is so critical to actually getting these things functioning, to allow specialization and reliability in a protocol that does a job reliably and can then evolve in its own right without having to bother all of the other protocols around it, and without this interdependence on each other, so that if, you know, you change protocol A, that it breaks protocols B, C, and D. Like, that's the ridiculous method of thinking that you're going to put everything in the base chain, whereas doing a layered approach allows for, it requires a deeper bootstrapping phase, but after you get across that, after you hit the first and second layers or excuse me, after you create the foundations for those second and third layers, everything accelerates to such a ridiculous degree that it will surpass everything. I think lightning is absolutely the best way to go, like no questions asked. And it does so without compromising the unbelievable reliability, the ease of verification, and the access to proving the base layer and securing the ownership and the value of Bitcoin, and enables a payments layer. It enables an application and essentially a web layer on top of Bitcoin. And I think it's going to be absolutely critical to its success. And I love it. And it's one of the things that just utterly, utterly consumes me whenever I dig into those topics. So a huge thank you to Thibault Marichal. Hopefully I've said that name roughly correctly. Thank you so much for writing this article. And of course, a huge shout out to Bitcoin Magazine for publishing this. Bitcoin is the future. We've got the Lightning Network protocol and the Bitcoin protocol, the new stack of the monetary internet. The future is upon us, ladies and gents. I am Guy Swan, and I will catch you all next time on Bitcoin Audible. And until then, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.